Good morning and welcome to today's edition of Times the Brief. I'm Harvey Kojan and these are the top stories of the day.
Here's what you need to know about the upcoming election in Japan by Charlie Campbell. Japan goes to the polls on Sunday to elect a new government, with chaos in the opposition ranks meaning incumbent Prime Minister Shinzo Abe is almost certain to be returned despite his approval rating plummeting to just 26% earlier this year. An election victory for Abe's conservative Liberal Democratic Party would make the 63-year-old Japan's longest-serving post-World War II leader and inject new impetus into his plans to overhaul Japan's pacifist constitution and take a continued hard line with North Korea. Why now? Abe called the election a year early because the opposition is in disarray. The Liberal Democratic Party has effectively been dissolved, and Abe's most feared political rival, Tokyo's popular governor, Koiki Yuriko, hasn't had the opportunity to mount a proper challenge with her new Party of Hope, which she launched just as Abe dissolved the national legislature, or Diet. Abe is caught up in two corruption scandals, and some suspect dissolving the Diet was simply a way to avoid a grilling from lawmakers. Although Koike leads the Party of Hope, she chose not to stand for the Diet in order to continue running the Japanese capital of 13 million, effectively aborting any power grab. Victory on October 22nd would boost Abe's chances of being re-elected Liberal Democratic Party president in September, thus potentially remaining in power until the year after the 2020 Tokyo Olympics. So, an Abe victory is certain? A fifth of voters remain undecided, but Abe should win. The bigger question is whether he will retain his two-thirds legislative supermajority. Latest polls suggest he will. Nevertheless, it has hardly been an aspiring campaign. A majority of backers of his proposal to revise the Constitution would prefer he not be the man to do it, while steadfast supporters of his Liberal Party would likewise prefer him not to be its leader. He took a gamble, the timing was perfect, and it looks like he's going to come up aces, says Professor Jeff Kingston, Director of Asian Studies at Tokyo's Temple University, Japan. But it's the most lukewarm enthusiasm imaginable for a leader that's going to romp home to victory. What are the issues? With the Liberal Democratic Party effectively neutered and Koike, a former defense minister under Abe, adopting a manifesto virtually as conservative as the incumbents, there is little chance of a major shift in policy after the ballot. One divergence is on nuclear power, which remains a hot-button issue 7 years after the Fukushima power plant meltdown. Abe says restarting Japan's nuclear reactors will help meet climate change commitments and reduce reliance on expensive fossil fuel imports. Koike wants nuclear power phased out and renewables to comprise a third of total energy supply by 2030. Abe's most contentious domestic policy is a proposed hike in consumption, sales tax, from 8% to 10% in late 2019. Abe says the funds are needed to prop up Social Security spending and to service Japan's debts, though he has attempted to assuage opponents by also promising a $17.8 billion stimulus package for schools, child care, and care for the elderly. Koike opposes the hike. What does this mean for Japan? Despite Japan's annual growth forecast growing from 2.5% to an upbeat 4%, a rise in exports despite a stronger yen, and a buoyant national bourse, economic worries still rank highest among Japanese voters. Abe is trying to play the nuclear power issue as the answer to rising energy prices, but few are sold on his signature Abenomics economic policy. Abe is also portraying himself as tough on security following the two North Korean missiles that flew over Japan's northern island of Hokkaido in recent weeks. Many Japanese are calling for the military capability to strike North Korean targets in the event of conflict. Some even want Japan to develop its own nuclear weapons. While Abe is unlikely to go that far, he remains determined to alter pacifist elements of the national constitution and deepen reform of the national armed forces. What does this mean for the U.S.? Abe hit it off better than anyone with U.S. President Trump during his golf-packed February visit to the U.S., where he presented Trump with a $3,800 Japanese-made gold-plated driver. The Japanese Prime Minister has been a staunch supporter of the U.S. security agenda throughout his terms, and a changing administration in Tokyo would inject uncertainty into the bilateral relationship at a time when Washington is trying to maintain pressure on rogue state North Korea. Trump is due to visit Japan early next month and would prefer to be meeting with his old clubhouse buddy when he does. Abe has lots of fans inside the Beltway, says Kingston. All the policy wonks are rooting for an Abe victory.
The FDA just approved a new way of fighting cancer using personalized gene therapy by Alice Park. Immune-based cancer treatments are surging forward as the Food and Drug Administration on Wednesday approved the second of a new technology called CAR-T, this time to treat diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, a type of non-Hodgkin lymphoma. In August, the agency approved the first CAR-T cell therapy, a type of gene therapy to treat acute lymphoblastic leukemia in children. CAR-T cell therapy, which stands for chimeric antigen receptor T-cell therapy, involves removing immune cells known as T-cells, genetically engineering them to recognize proteins on cancer cells and target them for destruction, and infusing the modified immune cells back into the patient. The treatment works the same way that immune cells eliminate bacteria and viruses. It's proving especially effective for blood cancers, since the immune system can ferret out an impressive number of cancer cells lurking anywhere in the blood and body. We think this therapy is here to stay. It's very different from chemo, says Dr. Frederick Locke, research director and clinical director of immune cell therapy at Moffitt Cancer Center in Tampa. This is a living, breathing therapy that we are putting back into the patient that can persist and continue to fight against the cancer. It's pretty amazing. In the trial the FDA reviewed, submitted by Kite Pharma and Gilead Sciences, 101 people with one of three types of lymphoma were enrolled to receive the treatment called Yescarta at 22 hospitals. All of the people in the study had tried and failed to respond to existing treatments of chemotherapy and stem cell transplants. They had no additional therapies available to them. Overall, 54% of these end-stage patients saw their cancers shrink or stop growing after 6 months, and 80% were still alive. The results are exciting and pretty much a game changer, says Locke, who oversaw one of the study sites. We know these patients might have a 1 in 4 chance of having any response to chemo and a less than 1 in 10 chance of a complete response. Yescarta could be useful for the 3,500 people in the U.S. who are currently exhausting their options for treating their lymphomas. As with the first CAR-T cell treatment approved, called Kymriah by Novartis, the therapy will only be available at 10 to 15 hospitals that have experience in managing the genetically modified cells and monitoring for the treatment side effects, which can be severe. During the trial for Yescarta, a patient died from a brain toxicity of the therapy. Because the treatment revs up the immune system, it can cause dangerous and potentially fatal swelling and inflammation. Doctors have learned to manage the complications, but it remains a risk of the CAR-T cell approach and one of the reasons it won't be available at every cancer center at first. Because people who have not responded to other treatments for their cancer may have compromised health overall, determining who will benefit and who might be more susceptible to the side effects will be a decision that doctors with experience in transplants and cell treatments will be in the best position to make. Locke says that treating the first signs of toxicity early also seems to reduce the severity of symptoms, and doctors will continue to investigate factors that can affect who might be more vulnerable to the side effects. For now, the therapy could provide another option for patients with end-stage lymphomas. Physicians at Moffitt Cancer Center are already planning to expand the hospital's resources in order to meet the anticipated demand.
The treatment is estimated to cost about $373,000, but experts note that if it is as powerful as the early results show, that high price tag could end up actually saving costs compared to the multiple rounds of chemotherapy and transplants over a period of years that most people with lymphoma currently pay for. You asked, is it bad to exercise on an empty stomach? By Markham Hyde. Are you the type to squeeze in a morning run before breakfast or hit the gym before dinner? Working out on an empty stomach won't hurt you, and it may actually help, depending on your goal. But first, the downsides. Exercising before eating comes with the risk of bonking, the actual sports term for feeling lethargic or lightheaded due to low blood sugar. You might feel tired or edgy, and you won't be able to work out as intensely as you would have if you'd eaten something, says Douglas Padden Jones, a muscle physiology researcher and a professor of aging and health at the University of Texas Medical Branch. A light amount of food will help get you through the workout session more comfortably and with more energy. It's extra important for older adults over 55 to eat something before exercising, especially when working out first thing in the morning. Throughout the night, our body makes physiological adjustments so we're able to survive, and that includes breaking itself down to sustain our blood glucose levels, says Nancy Rodriguez, a professor of nutrition sciences at the University of Connecticut. If you exercise in the a.m. before eating, she explains, your body continues to operate in this breakdown state, which can lead to muscle loss, a concern for many seniors. But if your primary exercise goal is weight loss, exercising on an empty stomach may come with some promising perks, though more research is still needed. There's some research to support the idea that working out in a fasted state can burn more fat than exercising in a fed state, Padden Jones says. One 2013 study of 64 people with obesity found that fasting every other day, eating just 25% of their typical daily calories, while doing an aerobic training program, led to greater weight loss than diet or exercise alone. But the evidence is mixed. Some studies have also failed to find weight loss advantages associated with fasting when compared to traditional diets. Other research suggests that skipping breakfast may be bad for your health. Even when fasting studies found benefits, the experiments were tightly controlled, and the people in them had help from nutrition scientists to ensure they got all the nutrients their bodies needed, Padden Jones points out. The hype about fasted cardio may also not prove true for everyone. You see some people advocating for fasted exercise on blogs and lifestyle sites, but these people tend to be young and in amazing physical shape, he says. Every other part of their diet and lifestyle is dialed in. They have no health issues, and when they eat, what they're eating is super high quality and carefully regulated. On the other hand, when an average Joe attempts a fasted cardio plan without proper planning or professional oversight, he may run the risk of nutritional deficiencies or unhealthy body composition changes, Padden Jones explains. Again, adults over 50 need to be careful fasting before a workout. Protein recommendations tend to be higher for older adults, and that protein may be more beneficial when spread throughout the day, says Shivani Sani, director of the nutrition program at Harvard University's Institute for Aging Research. I think a lot more work needs to be done on intermittent fasting and exercise before we can say, yes, this works well for this type of individual. For people who aren't athletes, fueling up with food before a workout may be the best way to get the most fat-burning benefit. Rodriguez recommends a small pre-exercise snack that combines protein and carbohydrates. Have a half a banana with a spoonful of peanut butter or a hard-boiled egg, she suggests. You don't want to fill up. You just want to give your body a burst of energy to power your training session. After you exercise, drink some water, but wait 60 to 90 minutes before eating. You're trying to take advantage of your elevated metabolic rate post-exercise, so if you can go for an hour or an hour and a half without eating, you'll maximize the fat-burning response, she says. This is general advice, of course, if you're bodybuilding or training for a marathon, or if you have a metabolic disease like diabetes, you should speak with a doctor or registered dietitian to design a plan that suits your needs. Meet the woman who started the hashtag MeToo 10 years ago, by Samantha Cooney. Following allegations of sexual harassment and abuse against Hollywood producer Harvey Weinstein, actor Alyssa Milano called on social media users to speak up if they were survivors of sexual harassment or assault. Women across the world, including Michaela Maroney, Anna Paquin, and Deborah Messing, shared their experiences, and hashtag MeToo soon started trending. But while many credited Milano with launching the movement, it was actually started a decade ago by Tarana Burke. Milano has attributed the movement to Burke on social media. In 2007, Burke, who is a survivor of sexual violence herself, was working as an activist in Philadelphia with young women of color who had experienced sexual violence. She was looking for a way to let them know that they weren't alone, so she told them, "Me too." Before I worked with them, I had an experience with a young person who was a survivor, and I couldn't speak to them honestly because I was still dealing with my issues. But I just knew that everything would have changed if I'd been able to tell that person I was going through the same thing they were, Burke said. I wasn't able to then, but I am now. Burke spoke to Motto about her reaction to the viral movement, how we get men involved in the conversation, and her advice for fellow survivors who might be traumatized by the past week. Question: what was your first response when you saw the hashtag had gone viral? Answer: I wasn't sure what direction it was going to go in. I was concerned that it would be a moment instead of a movement. I have less concerns about it sticking now. How did you feel when people pointed out that you were the person who started this movement after it had initially been credited to Alyssa Milano? I was glad and happy that people had recognized my work. I was initially inundated with texts and messages from friends who told me, "Wait, I'm seeing hashtag MeToo everywhere, but I'm not seeing your name attached to it. What's going on?" So it was so great that people knew my work, supported my work, and wanted to make sure it was properly credited. Some people have criticized Me Too because it puts the onus on women rather than men to disclose their past traumas to make a point. What's your response to that criticism? I've been doing this work for a long time, and I use my story as a means of healing others. I did struggle at the beginning to talk about it, but at this point, I've been talking about it for so long, and that's the whole point of the movement, that I emphasize and understand what other survivors are going through because I have my own story. Women of color are so often excluded from the conversation about sexual violence. Do you feel like their voices were amplified enough in this viral moment? This hashtag and viral moment wasn't centered on women of color, and I don't know if the hashtag has amplified the voices of women of color. Women of color, queer folks, differently abled folks, and other marginalized communities, we always have to insert ourselves into this conversation. That's not a new phenomenon. And this work can't grow unless it's intersectional. We can't do it alone, and they can't do it alone. Sexual violence knows no race, class, or gender, but the response to sexual violence absolutely does. Until we change that, any advancement that we make in addressing this issue is going to be scarred by the fact that it wasn't across the board. Hashtag MeToo has pushed the pervasiveness of sexual violence to the forefront of the national conversation. What can we do to capitalize on this movement and actually make real change in how we address this issue? Well, we can't get caught up with what's happening in Hollywood. What's happening in Hollywood is a microcosm of what's happening around the world and every day in people's communities, families, and homes. For every Harvey Weinstein, there's 3,000 or 4,000 other pastors, coaches, teachers, uncles, cousins, and stepfathers who are committing the same crimes. We have to keep that in focus, and we have to keep talking about it. So what should we do to address these issues in our own communities? We have to be brave. This kind of work takes courage. I'm not trying to say it like, get yourself some courage and get out there. But if you're watching something like this happen, if you're a bystander while this is happening, and you feel uncomfortable and that the situation is wrong and you need to do something, I want to encourage people to find the strength to intervene. There's so much you can do, from writing a letter anonymously to saying, hey, that's not right, you can't do that. People have to speak up. How do we get men more involved in the conversation? I don't know that I have an answer to that. In moments like this, when we elevate the voices of women and show just how much of a problem this is, maybe men will turn to each other and say, we need to talk about this. I think there are a lot of women who want men to do some of this work. A lot of them want to say, I can't be the survivor and the supporter. I have to figure out what healing looks like for myself, and then I have to help my perpetrator? That's not fair. The perpetrator should be doing that work. We should collectively be talking to children, as young as kindergarten, about what consent looks like. Men need to help reshape the conversation around consent. Men should be talking to each other to figure out what they can do to stop rape culture. That's an area where they especially have a job to do. This week has been empowering for a lot of women, but it's also been really traumatizing and hard for others. What would your message to a fellow survivor be? We are experiencing a moment of mass disclosure, which can be very triggering for folks. There are a lot of people who are turned off by this movement, and I get it. There's not a clear message or outcome. It's not like people are saying, yes, me too, and then getting a list of steps to follow to heal and make change on this issue. And that's what I hope to provide for folks in the coming weeks and days. But in the meantime, be gentle with yourself. Take your time. Figure out what you need. Don't be afraid to ask for what you need. Don't let anyone shame you into feeling like what you need is dumb. And don't let anyone diminish your experience. I want survivors to know that healing is possible. There are various entry points to this journey, and the journey is long, hard, and there are going to be times that you're going to need to stop and take a step back. When you are a survivor of sexual violence, it permanently alters your life. So that journey to healing is a journey back to yourself, and that's always worthwhile. This interview has been condensed and edited for clarity. 7 Tips for Getting Better Hotel Rooms for Cheap by Paul Schrott. It's an open secret of the hotel industry. There are almost always perks and discounts on hotel rooms that aren't heavily marketed. And to entice travelers, many ways have popped up over the last few years to focus your research and score cheap hotel rooms at your favorite spots. Follow these rules and you're sure to snag a great hotel room at a cheaper price. Become a regular and use the hotel's app. Hotels, like any business, treat their regulars a little more fondly. In the old days, that meant booking rooms directly with the hotel over the phone and getting to know the staff, which you can still do. But it also helps a lot to register with a hotel's app, if it has one. Major chains like Hyatt, Hilton, and Marriott do, and enjoy the bundled extras. The Hilton Honors app, for instance, easily allows you to accumulate points toward future stays while you book hotel rooms from your phone. And you get to choose your own hotel room from the available selections ahead of time, which means you not only get a cheaper hotel room, but you get a better room than you would at the front desk. Pro tip, go for the corner room, which will usually have more space at no extra cost. Members also get to enjoy bonuses like late checkout, express checkout, a free stay for a guest, a free extra night, and discounts on rooms. Book hotel rooms at the last minute. It may seem counterintuitive, but you're not going to score a cheap hotel room by making your reservation months ahead of time, though you'll have more selection. In fact, one of the best times to book a room as far as price goes is at the last minute, a day or two before you're staying, when others have canceled their bookings for the same time frame. Luxury hotels with empty rooms will be eagerly trying to fill those hotel rooms and drop their prices accordingly. Which is why you should harness the power of Hotel Tonight. Assuming, that is, you're okay with being flexible and booking a room just before you arrive at your hotel. Hotel Tonight is an app that specifically scours for last-minute hotel deals on premium spots. A search on the app as of this writing found a same-night hotel room at Los Angeles' boutique Inn at Playa del Rey during Friday, peak time, for $225, which would have normally been $345. Hotel Tonight has partnerships with about 15,000 hotels in 35 countries. Alternately, if you don't want another app, travel sites like Expedia and Kayak offer last-minute deals too. If you don't want to look last minute, set hotel price alerts. Websites like Hotels.com, Priceline.com, and Kayak allow you to sign up for alerts when prices on hotels drop. With Priceline.com's Name Your Own Price tool, you can even submit a bid based on what you would like to pay for various hotel options. Find the secret hotel room. If you sign up for Hotels.com's membership program, you get access to secret prices for hotel rooms, which offer steep discounts. Basically, these are rooms that hotels are trying to fill during slower times. The listings, which aren't publicly searchable, are then offered to the site's regular users for cheap. Consider the business hotel. Who says you need to stay at a resort to enjoy your holiday getaway? Hotels in major metropolitan areas that are geared toward business customers list cheaper hotel rooms on the weekends, which are peak times for those vacation-oriented hotels. And they often come up with great amenities even if you're just relaxing and not attending a conference. Conversely, vacation-oriented hotels generally have better deals in the middle of the week, so book accordingly. Nudge your way to that free room upgrade. A free hotel room upgrade is by no means guaranteed, but it's also more attainable than you might think. There are a few solid rules to working your way toward a sneaky upgrade. Check in at the end of the day or in the evening when the hotel staff has a better sense of what's taken and what's available. If for some reason your room selection has been filled, they'll often put you in a better room at the same cost. Be as friendly with the staff at the front desk as possible and politely ask if there happen to be any deals at the moment. Make sure you do this when the front desk isn't busy, though. And of course, don't forget to smile. It never hurts.
Border wall prototypes are being erected outside San Diego. By Eli Mexler. Funding for President Donald Trump's border wall may be mired in Congress, but along the U.S.-Mexico border, there's been a little more progress. 8 models of Trump's long-promised border wall, now with an estimated price tag of $1.6 billion, have been erected in San Diego's Otay Mesa outskirts. 4 of the wall models are made of concrete, 4 of concrete with steel reinforcements, and 1 is topped with spikes, NPR reports. All stand between 18 and 30 feet in height and are being built by 6 firms at a cost of $20 million for the U.S. Customs and Border Protection, which selected the firms in late September. Contracts range from $400,000 to $500,000, Reuters reported at the time. We want a better barrier, one that's hard to scale, hard to penetrate, and hard to tunnel under, says Roy Villarreal, San Diego Border Patrol chief. Local CPB officials are aware that they're courting controversy with the wall prototypes, saying it could even become the kind of national political magnet that drew protesters to North Dakota's Standing Rock Sioux Reservation last year to protest the Dakota Access Pipeline. Officials set aside a free speech zone for demonstrators, but none have shown up yet since construction started 3 weeks ago. The construction has caught the attention of Trump, however, who tweeted a video montage on October 18th. The wall is still far from a reality, however. Congressional Democrats have demanded that border wall funding be removed from any deal to reform DACA, the Obama-era immigration plan to protect some 800,000 undocumented immigrants who came to the U.S. as children. The state of California also filed a lawsuit in San Diego court in late September to block the wall's construction.
Doing this for 30 minutes a day can help you live longer. By Amanda McMillan for Real Simple. It sometimes feels like if you want to truly make a difference in your health, you need to hit the gym every day or make every workout as intense as possible. But new research suggests that simply walking more can have a real impact on lifespan. In fact, people in the study who walked just 150 minutes a week or more had a 20% lower risk of premature death compared to those who walked less. Even for people who didn't meet those 150 recommended minutes of activity per week, walking at least a little bit was still better than getting no exercise at all, found the American Journal of Preventive Medicine study. Lead author Alpa Patel, a researcher with the American Cancer Society, says the study is good news for anyone who worries that walking doesn't count as exercise. In our study, close to 95% of people who engaged in any physical activity did some walking, but for half of those people, walking was the only moderate to vigorous exercise they got, she says. Now we can see that it really does have real benefits. The study, which followed nearly 140,000 people for an average of 13 years, compared adults who got no physical activity at all, those whose only exercise was walking, and those who walked plus did other types of exercise. It also compared people who got more than the recommended 150 minutes of activity per week and those who got less. The people in the study were mostly senior citizens with an average age of 70. During the study's follow-up period, about 43,000 of them died. Compared to people who reported getting some physical activity at the start of the study, but less than 2 hours a week, those who reported getting no activity at all were 26% more likely to have died. Those who got between 2.5 and 5 hours of physical activity a week, on the other hand, had a 20% lower risk of death. Whether people achieved their 150 minutes a week of physical activity through only walking or through other activities didn't seem to matter. Both groups reaped similar longevity benefits. In the walking-only group, those who walked the most were better protected against death from respiratory disease, cardiovascular disease, and cancer than those who walked the least. This wasn't surprising to the researchers, because walking has previously been associated with a lower risk of heart disease, diabetes, and breast and colon cancers. But Patel was a bit surprised that the people who only walked got almost as much benefit as those who got other types of exercise as well. Only half of U.S. adults, and even fewer adults 65 and older, meet the recommended guidelines of 150 minutes of moderate activity or 75 minutes of vigorous activity per week. For those people, Patel says, simply aiming to meet that threshold could have real implications on longevity. The average pace people in the study walked was at 3 miles per hour, or a 20-minute mile. It's faster than you'd walk in the grocery store, and it's enough to get your heart rate up a little bit, but it's not like they were power walking or jogging, says Patel. Walking is the most common type of physical activity that people engage in the United States, so I was very, very happy to see these results. When the researchers compared individuals who got more than 150 minutes of activity to those who got less, they did not include the small percentage of people who reported getting no activity at all. People who are completely inactive, especially in this age range, may be that way because of underlying health reasons that keep them from being able to walk, says Patel. We didn't want to overestimate the benefits of walking, so we only wanted to include people who were healthy enough to get around. The researchers also excluded people with chronic health conditions from their study and controlled for factors such as smoking status and obesity. Still, the study could only find an association between walking and longer life, not a cause and effect relationship. For people who enjoy more vigorous forms of exercise, there's no reason to stop. Other studies have shown that higher intensity workouts also have benefits of their own. But for the millions of Americans who aren't even getting the minimum recommendation for physical activity, Patel says the evidence in support of walking more at any age is strong. I hope this encourages people, especially older adults, but really anyone who's not engaging in a physical activity regimen, that they don't have to go out and become a marathon runner, says Patel. Going from nothing to something provides a tremendous health benefit to overall longevity, and simply meeting those guidelines can provide even more. This article originally appeared on RealSimple.com.
Thanks for joining us. I'm Harvey Kojan, and you've been listening to the Daily Edition of Times the Brief. To get this sent to your inbox every morning, go to time.com/thebrief. You can also subscribe through iTunes or your favorite podcast app. I'll be back tomorrow. Until then, enjoy the day.